And welcome to the show. This is, I think, episode 6 or 7, and maybe the second time with a returning guest. And I'm very happy to have him because even though it's only been a few months, I have a gazillion more questions. Our guest today is Brian Gadawa. Brian, welcome again to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Mike.
This is really exciting because you released the third book in the series, The Chronicles of the Apocalypse. So if people are just listening in and they're kind of interested in that, maybe you can give, I mean, I don't even know where to start with your bio. You got so many cool things going on. So maybe just a small recap how your initial books, The Chronicles of the Nephilim, kind of morphed or gradually grew into this series that we're talking about today.
Yeah, maybe 6-7 years ago, I started the Chronicles of the Nephilim, and the first novel I ever wrote was Noah Primeval, and it was a story about Noah before the flood and such, and my whole sort of spiritual understanding of the Bible sort of transformed when I discovered Michael Heiser and his book, The Unseen Realm, which is a really amazing evangelical, and he's a scholar, and he's a Bible believer. He's not a liberal scholar by any means, but he really uncovered this sort of storyline thread of the Bible that I had not seen before. And it wasn't a sort of a secret knowledge, Gnostic revelation. It was more like, you know, the heart and soul of it was, you know, we tend to come to the Bible and read it with our own modern Western mindset, and we miss so much of the context of the ancient Hebrew, and we need to seek to understand the ancient Hebrew worldview and mindset and how they understood images and symbols, and we can discover a lot more that's in the text than we would realize. And you know, some of that had to do with the Nephilim and some wild things like what I would call the war of the seed in the Bible, which is like the notion of the seed of the serpent versus the seed of Messiah, and how those seeds throughout the whole Old Testament and New Testament was sort of a battle, you know, between the messianic seed and Satan, right? And so when I discovered this understanding through Heiser, and it sort of linked and explained a lot of the weird verses in the Bible that I never understood, and just whatever, you know, just kept moving, kept reading, you know, whether it's, you know, the Nephilim were in the land before the flood, to later when it talks about how there are these giants who are hunting down King David, you know, and I'm like, you know what? You know, some Christians don't even know that's there, but it's definitely in the text. And so I just wanted to retell these Bible stories, be consistent with the Bible, be true to it, but yet sort of fill in with some fiction and try to make sense of a lot of this stuff, and do it in an entertaining way where I would sort of, I wanted to pull back the curtain on the spiritual realm, because, you know, the Bible talks about there being angels and such, but, you know, it doesn't show us a lot about that world. So, you know, I wanted to say, okay, I want to write a theological series of novels that's entertaining, but I want to pull back that curtain and try and show what might it look like in the spiritual realm as well as the earthly realm. So that was my Chronicles of the Nephilim, and it's been a top 10 bestseller on Amazon Biblical Fiction for the last 6 years. But I realized when I was finishing that series, I ended on Jesus and his ministry, and I realized that technically the story wasn't finished yet, because there was Jesus talked a lot about in his parables and in his teachings. He talked a lot about something that Christians tend to miss, or they don't see this because they're focused on other things, but it's right there in plain sight, and that is he talked about the destruction of the temple. And he was prophesying, you know, and the classic chapter is, of course, Matthew 24, where Jesus talks about how one stone will be left upon another on this temple. And why? What's the point? Well, part of his ministry that Jesus had to the first century Jews was to proclaim himself as Messiah. But what did he keep saying? He kept saying this adulterous generation would not accept me. They would kill me. They would reject me. And in, you know, over and over again, what, you know, the parables, right? You know, the parable of the tenants in the vineyard, that they would kept rejecting the prophets. And when God sent his son, they would ultimately kill him. And what do you think that the owner of the vineyard will do when he finds out? He's going to come back and destroy them, right? And so Jesus gave all these parables, and he talked a lot about this. But in Matthew 24, he talks about how the generation that would kill Messiah, that first century generation, would be the blood guilt of all the prophets would be upon them. In other words, you know, because they would kill the Messiah himself, who would be the climax of God's revelation, right? They would have the highest guilt, and the punishment of that would be the destruction of the temple of God, their very holy city of Jerusalem, and the temple. And then he goes and he describes that destruction in Matthew 24, and that was something that I had understood, but I didn't realize how much it fit in with that paradigm of these, you know, angelic, well, let's call it this way, the spiritual warfare that I kind of perceived in the Bible. And so I wanted to tell that story, and I started a new series called Chronicles of the Apocalypse. And the premise of the series is I'm telling the story of the first century church starting in the 60s, AD 60s, shortly after the end of the book of Acts. So we know in the Bible we've got all the book of Acts that started the church, but then that's it. It ends, and we don't have anything else after that. Well, there is historical documents, and from the AD 60s up to AD 70, a period about, you know, about 10 years almost, there's a lot of amazing things that are occurring. First of all, we have Nero, who persecutes the church with the first official persecution of Christianity. So I tell that story and what it was like to be a Christian in that time period under Nero. But here's the key thing. In the AD 60s was the time period where John wrote the book of Revelation. Now, most Christians, you know, this is obviously a very controversial area of interpretation, the book of Revelation. Most Christians assume that book of Revelation has to do with our distant future, even now, right? But based on my studies, I believe that most of what Revelation was written for was about that destruction of Jerusalem that was coming. And so he was trying to warn the Christians to get out of Jerusalem because it was going to be destroyed, because God was coming to judge that first generation of Jews for killing Messiah, just like Jesus said. And so Revelation is a very symbolic book that points to that. And I came to understand that because if you look at the book of Revelation, everything in there, all the images, all the symbols have a precedent in the Old Testament. So you can find out what they mean, not by looking in our newspapers, but by looking and seeing, well, what did these images mean to the ancient Hebrews who used them, you know, before in prophecy and apocalyptic? And so my goal was, okay, I don't want to write a theology book here because that can be very complex for some people, and we've got a lot of those. And I thought, Left Behind was a really popular, obviously hugely popular series that was describing the dispensational interpretation of Revelation. And my goal was not to rip off that because I was already writing my storyline along with the Chronicles of the Nephilim. But my goal was to say, okay, I think that writing a fictional story within the context of what you believe is the historical truth is a powerful way of communicating theology in an entertaining way that people can grasp in a better way sometimes than reading theology. So that's what I wanted to do, and that's what my goal was, and that's what I've been doing with Chronicles of the Apocalypse. Like you said, I just released the third book this month called Resistant, Revolt of the Jews. And one of the key stories that I'm telling is the fall of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple. And we have one dominant historical source on that incident written by a famous Jewish historian named Josephus. And it's called The Wars of the Jews. And Josephus was a Jew Pharisee who actually fought against the Romans when the Romans came into Israel to conquer it, right, in AD 67. Josephus actually fought against them, got caught, and ended up going over to the side of the Romans, helping them with the goal of trying to get the Jews to surrender because he believed that the Jews were being punished for disobedience to Yahweh. So he was trying to get them to surrender. And he did so by, you know, helping the Romans know where the weaknesses were and to try to help to persuade the Jews. And anyway, they obviously didn't. And the Romans ended up destroying the temple through Titus and such. So this is an amazing storyline in history that I'm retelling in my series, and I'm also showing how it's connected to the book of Revelation and interpretations of the end times, but I'm also making it based on historical research. So my goal is to tell this time period of history for Christians in a way that even if you don't agree with my interpretation of Revelation, you'll still learn an amazing thing about the history of that time period, because that event was singularly determinative in changing the history of both Judaism and Christianity. That destruction of the temple marked a transformation from Judaism, from a Torah-based religion to a rabbinic-based religion, because once they lost the temple, they could no longer engage in the Torah sacrifices, right? So they had to create a new religion to sort of make up for it, and that's what they did. And then Christianity was once heavily connected to Jerusalem and to Israel, because obviously the first Christians were Jews, right? And Christianity was actually the messianic fulfillment of Judaism, so it was obviously a family member in that sense. But the destruction of the temple and the city forced Christians to break out and go to all the nations like Jesus said they should, to disciple the nations. And from that point on, Christianity exploded. And so that's why I think that no matter what view you hold, this is an important historical time period to understand. And I think I'm telling a very entertaining story that will help make that bring sense to that whole picture, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's very entertaining. And we'll talk about the appendixes or appendici, however you want to say that in the back. But one thing that I would think that people would kind of say, okay, now this is where things have gone haywire is you're assuming that Revelation was written before the destruction of Jerusalem. So that's kind of a hot issue. Why do you stand on that side of that issue?
Well, there's a lot of evidences for it. First of all, anyone who's worth their salt or has done any honest looking into the issue will acknowledge that scholarship is not settled on that issue, and I don't know that if we ever will of when it was written. However, I would say that I come firmly down in the side where I think that it was written around 65 AD, roughly, and there's a lot of strong internal indications in the Book of Revelation, as well as external historical indications that it was written before the destruction. And for anyone who wants to know more about that, the single best book on the issue is a free book by Ken Gentry called Before Jerusalem Fell. And he goes over all the evidences for the early and late date and why the early date is actually superior argument. And you can get that book free. You go to my website, gidawa.com, click on Chronicles of the Apocalypse tab. And I have a tab that's called Scholarly Research. And I have a bunch of free books and free articles related to all the material that I'm writing on. And that book, Jerusalem, Before Jerusalem Fell, is one of the free books. And, your audience can go more in depth in the issue if they want.
Excellent. Thanks. So another one, growing up in a futuristic perspective, Matthew 24 was always read, but its counterpoint, Luke 21, was never read. And I don't know if it was Josephus or Eusebius, but one of them, said, hey, when this stuff was going down, the Jews actually followed Christ's words and fled. And I guess yes. The history shows they went to Pella.
Yes.
And that kind of made me like my head spin, because, of course, I was never taught that. This stuff is going to happen in the future when, I guess, the Antichrist or whoever rolls into the temple that doesn't exist, by the way. And then it's going to be difficult for this to happen now. Plus, if this generation was talking about this generation, well, we're already past a generation. But I think people are now saying it's 70 years. So it's happening now. But that idea of Matthew, and you obviously have done more research than I have, but Matthew was writing to Jews, right? And so that idea would be different than who Luke was writing to. So in Matthew, he said the abomination of desolation, but Luke spells it out a little different. And he says, when you see the Jerusalem being surrounded by armies, you'll know that its desolation is near.
Yes, there's a lot. I can't tell you, there's a dozen of these examples of things that are mysteries by the typical interpretation. What is the abomination of desolation? And everyone, and all these Christians are like speculating what it will be in the future. And like what you're saying, there's many examples like this where actually it's not that mysterious, because it's literally explained within the Bible and you just pinpointed one of them. So in Matthew 24:15, it says, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken by Daniel, you know, flee to the mountains. Well, and you're right. Matthew is written for Jews. He uses a lot of Jewish terminology, so they would know what abomination of desolation meant. Luke is writing mostly to Gentiles. They wouldn't know what that even means. So he's giving the same sermon that Jesus gave, but he says it a little bit differently in a way that would explain it. He says, when you see, not the abomination of desolation, he says, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, know that its desolation is near, then flee to the mountains, et cetera, et cetera. It's the same sermon with a slight variation of words so that the readers could understand what it means. And so you're absolutely right where, oh my gosh, it's something that has traditionally been understood to be this mystery. And I'm like, you know, wow, it's pretty obvious right there that he's talking about that time period in the first generation. And that's not the only case. I mean, Jesus says in Matthew 24:20, he talks about this, he goes, then there will be great tribulation such as never been in the beginning of the world, nor will never be. And everyone talks about this, when's the great tribulation? And they all assume it's this sort of, yes, it's the 7-year period, and, you know, when's it going to be? What's it going to be like? And that's another classic example where, and I bring all this stuff out in my novels as well, but it actually tells us in the Bible when that was taking place. If you go to the book of Revelation, and this is one of those shockers that, you know, it's just amazing. So very first chapter, John is, you know, telling us about Revelation. Chapter 1, verse 9, he says, I, John, your brother and partner in the tribulation, I was on the island of Patmos. So he's saying, when I'm writing this letter on Patmos, I am your partner in the tribulation. He doesn't say a tribulation like it's a generic term. No, it's this very specific, the tribulation. So in the book of Revelation itself, it says, the great tribulation that Jesus talked about, and John calls it great tribulation later as well in Revelation chapter 7, verse 14. But my point is that's the tribulation everyone talks about, and he's saying it was going on when he was writing the letter. So there are many, and I've got many more cases of examples like this that are just so amazingly clear right there in the text, but Christians have been, I think just because of our theologies, tends to blind us to seeing these things. So yeah, it's been fun to point these things out to Christians, and it's not as esoteric as you may think.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's part of the problem is, unfortunately, a lot of us really don't read the Bible as much as we should. So if you're in church and Matthew 24 is always read, but Luke 21 is never mentioned,
yes,
then you're going to have, you know, whatever agenda that they're wanting to sell you on, you know, is they're going to use the scriptures to defend that position.
Can I give you one more example? And
yeah,
this is relevant to my novels because, again, everything we're talking about, I incarnate into the story in a way that will make sense. But another thing of, you know, this whole thing of Revelation, just when I tell people, hey, did you know Revelation is not about judging the earth? It's about God judging Israel and Jerusalem. And they just go, what? And look, I know it's very controversial. So, you know, I know it's shocking. But if you drill down, you'll be amazed at some of the things that will come up. And this is one of those things that I like to point out. The very beginning of the book of Revelation, John is giving us, here's the theme of the book. Chapter 1, verse 7, he says, behold, he is coming with the clouds and every eye will see him. Well, that people automatically assume, well, that's got to be the second coming of Christ. And he says, even those who pierced him and all the tribes of the earth will wail on account of him. So he's saying, oh, see, it's the judgment of the earth. Everyone's going to be wailing because of it. But here's the problem. The word for earth in Greek, it's a bad English translation. It should not be earth, because when we read the word earth, what do we think? We think of the globe. That's not what the word means to them, because they didn't even have a notion of the globe. The word translated earth is better translated land, which land could be all that you see around you, or sometimes it could just be a localized place like the land of Israel. And in fact, when an ancient Jew heard the word the land, they often thought of Israel. And imagine this, when he says, all the tribes of the land, what does that sound familiar? That's the tribes of the land of Israel. But I'm not just making this up arbitrarily, like, oh, I'm trying to change, revise the definition of the word. And here's where the key comes in. John is actually quoting this verse, all the tribes of the earth will wail, those who pierce him. He's quoting Zechariah chapter 12. You go back and you read that passage, Zechariah 12, and what does it say? It says, all the tribes of the land, those who pierced him. It's talking about the tribes of Israel very clearly. So now imagine going through the book of Revelation, and everywhere you see earth, change it to land, and you'll start to see that this judgment is not of all the earth. It's a judgment of the land of Israel. Now, again, that changes everything, and I'm not saying anything that isn't right there in the text, and I'm not giving you a different definition. I'm giving you the Old Testament definition of that word quoted in Zechariah 12, and that's what John is quoting. So John himself is saying it's the tribes of Israel that are going to mourn. Why? Because they crucified the Messiah. And Jesus is saying that I'm going to vindicate myself. I'm going to prove to you that I'm seated at the right hand of the Father, that you rejected me. And I came for my people, but my own rejected me, right? He's saying that the destruction of Jerusalem and the destruction of Israel is going to be my judgment that proves to you that I am Messiah and you rejected Messiah, just like I prophesied would happen. And so it's very important to understand that this isn't just the book of Revelation. It isn't just this generic judgment of earth for, whatever. It's two things are happening here. Two things. One is, like I mentioned already, he's judging Israel for rejecting Messiah, and he's destroying the temple. But there's a second thing is, this book of Revelation is a story between two women, the harlot and the bride, right? And so the harlot is the unfaithful wife of Yahweh. Who's that? That's Israel. And the bride is the new bride of Christ, which is the new covenant church, so which includes both Jew and Gentiles who believe in Messiah. So he's basically saying the new covenant has arrived. The old covenant is dead. So God is going to our God is not a God of philosophy, but a God of history. So when he says that Jesus Christ, fulfills, all the sacrifices in the temple, right? And Jesus is the new temple of God, right? The temple's still standing. So God actually destroys the incarnation of the old covenant as the historical expression of the new covenant that has arrived in Christ. So you see what I'm saying is that God doesn't just do things philosophically or spiritually. He validates them in history by getting rid of the incarnation of the old covenant is what is his final historical statement that the new covenant has arrived in Christ. So this is a very powerful and beautiful symbolic expression of the new covenant arriving in and the kingdom of God arriving. And it's, those are some things that I think Christians can agree on, but they don't realize, well, that's exactly what's going on in the book of Revelation.
Yeah, that's one of the things that really kind of, not the first crack, but I was listening to a Christian Messianic Jewish, because a lot of Jews are Messianic, but not, they don't believe Jesus is the Messiah. But he said, it was kind of funny watching him, because he said, I don't know how this makes sense, but during this 1,000-year reign of Christ that, of course, he believed is going to happen in the future for exactly 1,000 years, the temple is going to be rebuilt and sacrifices will go on. I was like, but how offensive is that to the finished work of Christ? He thought it was odd, but his futuristic view wouldn't allow him out of that mindset. It seems like that is just, well, first of all, from an apologetic standpoint, the idea that there's good evidence that all the Gospels and all the epistles, I'll argue, were written before the temple destruction, or they would have said something about it, I would assume.
Exactly.
But the idea that Jesus said this within that generation and it actually happened is a huge apologetic platform, if you will. In fact, Anne Rice wrote a book about this, because she, and sometimes it's not as bad as it used to be, but some people were like, yeah, second century, some of this stuff was written, or, whatever. They're going way out there. But the evidence seems to show more and more that this was all written before the destruction of the temple. So this being the case makes a whole lot of sense. But I grew up in a denomination where your viewpoint wasn't even an option. But then when I started reading people like Luther and some more older theologians before I even went back to the early church, they at least were saying that some of these things that Jesus were talking about were talking about the destruction of the temple, but some of them were talking about the future end times. I didn't even hear that, the Lutheran middle, they call it, with so it's not like this is a new thing that you're just discovering or coming out with. So give us the history of how, because when you talk about this to people, they said, no, the early church fathers were expecting the rapture at any time and Christ to return. So where is your evidence that this is something that was held by the early church fathers? Not that that really makes that big of a difference, but if it's something you're just coming up with now, that could be problematic.
Yeah. Well, you know, look, there's, if you want to look into history, I don't do a lot of the historical, like all the viewpoints throughout history. I don't know as much as some others might, but I do know that from what little I've read, I have found basically elements of every viewpoint we have now going all the way back to the origin. You know, when people try to say, oh, our view was the first view or this or that, it just isn't true. There is examples of preterist views all the way back to, 100 AD and such. But there are also premillennial and there are also amillennial. Yes, they don't have the developed systems necessarily the way we have them because things change over time. But I found, elements of all the different beliefs. So I don't really think anybody can claim, oh, our view was the view, there was always disagreement and arguments.
And that's on every subject in the early church.
Absolutely. Which is why, the logical fallacy of, whoever beliefs are the earliest are the most truthful beliefs. That's called chronological snobbery, and that's a logical fallacy. So I would never argue, and I have never argued that, my view is better because it's earlier. I just don't think – I think that there's no argument because they could have been wrong early on. Who knows, But if you want to learn a little bit more about that just because you're curious, there is an author that I've read that's really good on this subject. His name's Francis Gummerlach, and he's written a couple books about my view that I'm describing here is called preterism. And it's a simple word that means – the past. It's Latin for the past. And it basically, the argument is the last days is not something in the future, the last days of the earth, but rather the last days are the last days of the old covenant. That's happened in the past. So we tend to believe that, Bible prophecies about the last days have occurred in the past, not in the future. But it's all about what does the word last days means. Again, do we come at the word last days and assume with our modern Western eyes, or do you look at it, well, what did they think? Why were they using the term, we were now in the last days? The Apostle Peter in Acts 2 says, Joel says these are last days, and this is being fulfilled right now. So, they believe they were in the last days in that first century. And what did it mean to them? And what I would argue, preterists believe it meant the last days of the old covenant. Now, Gummerlach has written a couple books that show that this belief has adherents that go all the way back to the early church. One book is called Revelation in the First Century, and another book is called The Early Church and the End of the World. And you can get those at AmericanVision.org. They're a great resource for these kinds of things. But again, it's not something I've done an extensive study on because, again, I'm more interested in, well, prove it from the Bible, not from history, because the truth is every view that has ever been, you can find an example of it in history. So I'm more interested in proving it from the text of the Bible itself.
So, I agree with you, because you can argue all sorts of, etymology of words and all that kind of stuff, but what does the text actually say? But just to be clear, you're not saying that Jesus is not going to return, right?
Right. I'm of the view that I still believe that there is a second coming of Christ and that there will be a final judgment and a bodily resurrection that occurs at the end of history. However, it's not linked to anything that we're used to hearing. In other words, there is no rapture. There's no seven-year tribulation. There's no coming Antichrist who will rebuild the temple and all that stuff. All that stuff was misinterpreted, in my view, because that was applied to the first century. And let me give you an example to paint the picture, is that the picture was that Nero was Nero Caesar, and the Roman Empire was basically that symbol of the beast in general, right? And so Nero was the one who was persecuting, and he was, you know, the harlot is a symbol of the apostate Jewish leadership of Israel, and they led Israel astray, and the harlot rides the beast, which means, in other words, the apostate Israel is in defiance against God along with the beast. And this is how some of these symbols were understood within their context, you know. So, I lost my train of thought there, but if that answers the question.
No, absolutely. And for people who do read the books, there are, you know, half the book sometimes is your research, which I find fascinating in the back, because it is a lot of, you know, biblical evidence. And then, of course, you've written some other books. But let's talk about the books for a little while, because the idea of story, you obviously believe that's a great way to transmit a message. And it depends on your view of the Bible, because some people don't believe right. The Bible used all sorts of, I was going through, you mentioned Dr. Michael Heiser. I was doing a little study that he had out on different genres. And one of them was comedy. And then I forgot, there was a couple of them that it never even dawned on me that those were in there. I think he specifically referenced with the comedy Zacchaeus, the idea that how absurd that would have been for a small little guy to shamefully run, you know, lifting, you know, that kind of thing, or climbing up, you know, whatever, that whole thing would have been a shameful comic story, at least back in that day. And ghost stories so there's a lot of different genres in the Bible, and telling stories is just a great way to not prove your point, because that's not really a good idea, but to tell the the archetypical story, or the archetypical idea, in a way that people can A, understand, and B, passed down. So your stories are great, and, you know, for people who don't know who Brian is or haven't read his bio, you know, you've done some screenwriting, and this is written like a movie, I think, to where, you know, I'm jumping from the one page I'm on to the second page without even finishing reading the bottom of the one I was on, because I'm trying to see what happens
next.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. How is this going to go down? And then you got these great little name changes in there that you're not expecting. All the way through from the beginning to the end. And the one good thing for me is I was able to see, especially I was able to put some flesh and soul onto these Old Testament stories or you were able to do it in a way that I've never understood. And it really humanized these people.
Yeah, that was my goal, which is why you mentioned, I tend to put appendixes in my books, or the latest series, Apocalypse series, I footnote, which is not something you would normally do for a novel, but because I know that Christians have a high view of Scripture, they're going to tend to, and they're going to be freaked, you know, not freaked out, well, sometimes they're freaked out, or sometimes they're shocked by what they're reading. I know they're going to think, wait a minute, is that in the Bible? You know, and I respect that, because, you know, it's like they don't want to believe something that's not true, and they don't want people playing with the Word of God. I respect all that. So that's why I footnote, and that's I give my research, so that anyone who's reading, if they really have problems with it, they can look it up, and I show you scholarly and from the Scriptures and from history where I got all the stuff, because what you're saying is true. Storytelling incarnates worldviews and theology in a way that can touch our humanity in a much more powerful way. And so I want to tell stories like, they're mostly action epics, you know. The latest series, Chronicles of the Apocalypse, I kind of call it like a Da Vinci Code thriller in the ancient world, you know, because the premise of the story, the very first novel, is called Tyrant, Rise of the Beast. And that's about Nero, of course, but the premise of the story is, you know, it's AD 64, the great fire happens in Rome, Nero blames it on the Christians, and then he gets advice from Jews to blame it on the Christians, and that way he'll escape being judged himself, because people think maybe he started it, right, because he wanted to rebuild Rome. So that's how it starts off, and but then he hears, where he gets the idea is, he hears that there's this letter, secret letter circulating that predicts the end of the world and assassination of the emperor. And so he sends out a Roman soldier, and the soldier has a Jewish doctor with him and a Christian slave. And that way I get the viewpoints of all the different viewpoints, right? And so this guy goes after it. Turns out that what he's looking for is the letter of Revelation, because the Revelation was written as an apocalypse. And an apocalypse uses symbols in order to, in one sense, it reveals God's truth to the believer, but it conceals it from the unbeliever, which means, you know, like Daniel did the same thing, right? Like if you're writing a letter that's critical of the empire, you know, you're going to be hunted down. So John wrote it in symbols so that it wouldn't be readily understood to the Romans. And so that's kind of how the journey starts out. And they're hunting down this letter, and the Christians are hiding it. And then it ultimately leads them to Patmos, and they find out, they find the Apostle John, and they find out what its real purpose is, and it's not what they thought it was. And then that's what leads them on a journey into Jerusalem. And then ultimately, the armies of Rome, when Nero finds out that, the Jews of that time period rose up in a revolt against Rome, and they were hoping for Messiah still to come, right? They rejected Jesus, but they were expecting Messiah's going to come and rescue us from Rome. So they have this revolt. Nero sends his armies under Vespasian into Israel to quench the revolt and ultimately just flatten the land out, right? And then that's what starts a 3.5 years basically trampling underfoot of the Holy Land and the Holy City. And that 3.5 years, of course, does match the 3.5 years in Daniel as well as Revelation. And so that's kind of that historical side of things. And that's why, and then as you're going through this journey with the Jew, the Roman, and the Christian, you start to see through their different eyes how they see these things differently and how they saw the world very differently as well, you know. And like I said, I have spiritual warfare going on as well, which is kind of cool for those who like that kind of stuff, sort of showing what's going on in the spiritual realm while the things are going on Earth. And, you know, just like the book of Revelation, right? The Revelation peels back the curtain and shows us some of that spiritual warfare going on, right? So I tried to make that consistent as well. So yeah, it's a very, like I say, it's entertaining, and I come from a Hollywood background, so I do tend to want to write in a way that it's like you're watching a movie, and so it's got a lot of rich imagery, a lot of action, romance, and all that kind of stuff, but all within the context of this this understanding of that early Christian church.
Excellent. And just again, to be clear, because people get, you know, they hear what you're saying, and then if they've never heard these alternate views before,
yeah.
Sometimes, I mean, I was like that too when I first started hearing this stuff. In fact, it was many, many years ago, but one thing that shocked me was I was listening to kind of a conspiracy theory futurist podcast that you were on. That's where I found out about you. And somebody, I guess, didn't know your belief in this and asked how the Nephilim were going to play out again in the end times. And,
yeah.
You said, you know, you didn't believe that. I thought those things were all connected, right? The Nephilim in a futuristic view. So when I first read stuff by, I'm not going to name any names, but just the futurist authors, there's a ton of them out there. This one particular who's a bestseller. And Jimmy Swaggart taught the same thing. He's got this record out on, you know, John was really talking about Apache helicopters and things he couldn't explain. You just said that he was speaking in a genre that already existed. And that was something really new to me that I was never taught.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that's the, you know, look, this is why I think that we have a long history, as we all know, of the end time speculation. And every generation, you know, within my lifetime, you know, back in the 1970s, they had everything worked out to be Russia, and it was all going to happen by 1988. And of course, it didn't happen, right? And these are famous guys like Hal Lindsey and Chuck Smith, and these guys were promoting, you know, Christ is going to come, the rapture is going to happen in the 1980s, and of course, it never did. And this there's like a cottage industry, and there's a lot of big money in the speculation of the end times for our future. And so, but I think that there's a downside to all this stuff. And that is that, you know, as I watch this stuff over the last 40 years, right. One of the things that started bothering me was they're always wrong. They're always wrong. And they're always changing. Like every few years they write a new book and they've changed all the symbols, what they mean. And now they mean Islam, and before it meant Russia. Now it means all this kind of stuff. And it started making me think, like, you know, maybe if they're always wrong over and over and over again over 40 years, and now they think, well, now we got it right, right? And I think, all right, technically you could say just because they've always been wrong for the last 40 years, of course it goes further back than that, hundreds and hundreds of years, but if they're always wrong in the past, doesn't mean they're wrong now. They could be right now. Yes, technically that's right, but think about this, folks. If they're wrong over and over and over again, maybe the problem isn't in the individual interpretations. Maybe the problem is with the system. And the system is wrong, and it's never right, and it never produces a right prediction. And that's what got me to start reconsidering, well, what are the other viewpoints, you know? And I learned, oh, there's an amillennial viewpoint and an idealist viewpoint that says, no, this is more of a cyclical thing. It's more generic. It applies to different points in history, but not specifically like the dispensationalists are saying, you know. And then there's also the protest view that says, well, a lot of this stuff actually applied to the past. And I just want to plead with Christians to read the other viewpoints. I've read all the viewpoints. I've actually believed all the viewpoints at different points in my life. Read the different viewpoints and be open-minded and just listen, because you'll learn something from any viewpoint, even if you don't agree with it. You'll learn something, and you may still agree with your own or may still believe whatever you believe, but I guarantee you'll learn something that you didn't know before, and it'll make you more open-minded, and it helped me to do so as well with other viewpoints. And that would be my pleading in today's world, because we're so polarized, right? And it just seems like whatever viewpoint you have, if you don't agree with the person, you're a heretic. And this is really becoming divisive in the body of Christ. And we've got to be able to be more open-minded and be able to agree to disagree. Listen, I was on a debate, just a friendly debate, just recently about this very thing. And we were debating who is the harlot in the book of Revelation. And I'm telling you, this guy got to the point where he started slandering me, publicly slandering me that my viewpoint, you know, was evil. And I just like, I blew my top, and I just said, this is irresponsible and immoral of you. You know, we've got to be able to talk about our ideas without having to accuse the other person of heresy just because they disagree with us and we think that it's serious. You know what I mean? And especially when we realize that great men of God through all of history, far greater men than we are, all right, have believed all these different viewpoints. So we have to be humble enough to at least entertain all other viewpoints. That's my plea, you know, because I've seen so much of this, and it breaks my heart to see the body of Christ so divisive when we can be learning from each other.
I agree. One thing, though, that I realized growing up in the futuristic view was there's it's not only that you have to maybe let go of some theological positions, but the idea that everybody's going to get theirs, and you get to be a part of that vengeance, coming back on a horse with Jesus, killing all the... There was almost a hatred in there that was encouraged to hate the sinner. And everything you saw was a sign of the Antichrist or the New World Order. But I felt a real way that people could group together and really hate other groups of people, and then really be excited about coming back and killing him with Jesus. So
yeah, you know, it seems to me like I see in the modern day speculation of the end times, I see a lot of interest in finding the Antichrist, not finding Christ, you know? And I'm like, you know what? We should be searching for Christ, not the Antichrist. And no matter what you believe, when I see a lack of the gospel, a lack of the emphasis on, you know, Jesus Christ and his kingdom that he is reigning on his throne right now in heaven at the right hand of God, and his kingdom is on this earth, and we are a part of a glorious kingdom. When I see that lack of understanding, that is also something that makes me be cautioned as well. Absolutely. And you know, I often talk to my futuristic friends, you know, who are, you know, they're looking into everything like transhumanism and the mark of the beast and all this stuff, and I often tell them, look, I'm like, sometimes a lot of your research can be helpful, because I would agree that it is wrong to put a microchip in our hands, because that leads to tyranny. But that doesn't mean it's the mark of the beast, and it doesn't mean it's a fulfillment of prophecy. all it means is mankind is still sinful, and mankind will always try to be tyrannical, right? It doesn't have to be a fulfillment of prophecy to be evil to be able to fight it. And so I agree with them about some of their accusations that transhumanism is dangerous, it's evil, etc. I just don't think that it has some kind of end times flavor to it. And that's where we can agree to disagree. You know, we can have some kind of agreement, but then also we can have some area of disagreement as well.
If they're willing to fellowship with you.
Yeah. And a lot of times that doesn't happen. But a lot of times I do. I'm able to go on a lot of different podcasts, and I have to say these guys are kind enough to have me on, even though we disagree on just about most all the end time stuff altogether. But they'll have me on, and I think that that's a good sign. But nevertheless, there are times, like I said, that happened recently where I'll be slandered publicly, and this should not be going on in the body of Christ, you know? So.
Absolutely. Well, I could talk to you forever, but we're out of time, and we'll save the rest for next time. But if people want to find out what you're doing, I guess Godawa.com is the best place to do that, right?
Yeah, there's all, and look, it's not just a boring, informative site. There's a bunch of free artwork. I cast all my novels. I've got cool artwork. I've got free scholarly articles. So if you want to learn more before jumping into it, you're still a little like, oh, I don't know. I want to know more about this guy. Everything's on my website, Godawa.com. But if you're willing to check out the novels, I sell all my books are exclusively on Amazon. You can get them in paperback, ebook, or audiobook form. And, you know, you can go there to do some shopping if you want to see. You know, I have descriptions of the books there as well. So, yeah, those are the two places you want to hit.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much. And when the new one comes out, we'll talk again.
Thanks a lot, Mike.